about your own experience, you can't hold anything back because people know you are. People, readers know you, well, you're doing that, and they'll stop reading, or they won't buy the book, or nobody will recommend it to them. So it was hard to, actually take a step to reveal things and then how to write about it.
Welcome to Literary Gumbo 2.0. This is the reboot of a video program I co-produced between 2010 and 2017. I'm your host, Lisa Engel. The right angle to help you write and sell your story. Each episode explores the world of writing, publishing, and book marketing. Sit back and enjoy.
So I'm here today with author Bruce Lyandike, and his brand new book is Mighty Bad Land, A Perilous Expedition to Antarctica Reveals Clues to an Eighth Continent. Hi, Bruce.
Hi there, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
Now, Antarctica, not a lot of people write about Antarctica. So why Antarctica? What got you interested in that?
Well, it stems from my scientific expertise and interests in geology and specifically plate tectonics. And I actually was in New Zealand working on a project with a colleague in the Southern Alps, and we noticed how difficult it was to do geology there in a place where there's so much vegetation, so much rain, so much weathering. And we also noticed that there's a mountain range there in New Zealand that might be a correlate to the mountain range in Antarctica, a place called Marie Birdland. And we thought it would be really interesting to work on that mountain range to learn about the other mountain ranges. So Antarctica versus New Zealand. And New Zealand and Antarctica once were joined in the supercontinent of Gondwana, but we're not exactly sure how or where. So it's kind of a notion of, well, the torn newspaper idea. The newspaper is torn, and you got print on one side of it and then print on another side of it. And you can read both of those prints. You're likely to be able to match them up and have a convincing argument. They were once one piece. So that's basically how we got
there. This was part of a university or a government, or who funded this research?
Yeah, both. The National Science Foundation, it's a U.S. federal agency, funds competitive grants and to work in Antarctica. And they provided the green light. And also the most of the money, some money from university support, not a lot. And then there's also some hidden costs that were provided by the logistical support from the U.S. Navy and some other government agencies. So basically, it's a competitive process. You apply for a grant to the National Science Foundation based on hypothesis you want to test, or like I just explained to you about the matching up of New Zealand and Antarctica. So that's the long answer to your short question.
So you got to Antarctica, and was it what you expected?
It was as extreme as I expected. It was harder than I expected. Just about anything you do on the continent is hard work. It's not easy physically and mentally also. So that was kind of when people ask me how was it in Antarctica, was it cold? And I say, yeah, but you know what, it was really hard. That was harder than I expected.
This book, is it you're a scientist and you did a lot of scientific work while you were in Antarctica. So is this book, would you call this book a science book, or how would you classify this?
It's a memoir adventure story about doing science. The first versions I had in it of the book were pretty too heavy on science content, because I was aiming at a general audience, a knowledgeable lay audience who was interested in adventure travel and historical experiences in the Antarctic. And I had to, I went through enough publishers where they told me, well, you got to tone down this science some. So it took me several versions to address that issue. And what I ended up doing in the book is creating an appendix in the book, which has got a pretty hefty science chapter. But the most of the book is a book of a journey, an experience, my personal experience and experiences of my small team, six people in the Antarctic wilderness.
So there is a lot of adventure in there.
I would say so, yeah. First of all, everyday living on your own in a place where there's no supplies. I mean, if you need a paperclip, you better have brought it. That's an adventure, just living day to day. Like, for instance, where do you get water? There's a lot of snow around, but there's no water. So you have to melt the snow. How do you melt the snow? Well, you better have a stove, and you better have fuel for the stove so you can get the snow and a pot to melt it in. So there's everyday living, taking care of everything on your own with this, with what you've been dumped out there with. And then when you're doing the work, of course, you have to go out into the environment and face all of its unforeseen challenges and unseen menaces, as I put it in the book. So there's a spectrum of activity, from the humdrum survival, figure out how to do this, to, uh-oh, we're in trouble now, that type of story.
So I can see that that would be a good story. So you do have, I can see wanting to get this book and reading this book to find out, you know, if I was to go back in time and become an explorer or a scientist who goes to Antarctica, what would it be like? A lot of people don't know what that would be like. And you actually have that experience and you've shared that experience. So is that mainly why you wrote the book?
And there's a couple of reasons why it took me a long time to decide to write it, including that I was employed full time as a university professor, and I didn't have like any extra time to go into a book project, which does absorb a lot of your presence. Also, I found that I was thinking about Antarctica and my experiences just about every day. It was kind of, even when I was doing my job, and I went 9 times, but this is the first, the book's about the first time, I found that I was thinking about it every day, but I didn't quite know what it meant to me, what the impact was on me. I just knew it was profound. And I didn't think I could really write about it until I had some idea of what the impact was on me and what the message was I could relay to a reader about my personal experience and the impact of me on me personally.
But now you have that book, and so how do you feel about the finished product, what people are going to buy?
I'm pretty excited about it. I have multiple versions of the book. You know, I started it out of, when was it? Early in the 2010s with local teachers, Shelley Lowenkopf and Tony Lipopolo. And I wrote like individual chapters. And then I figured out a way to, they helped me figure out a way to connect them into a story of a beginning, middle, and an end. And the journey that's in there, you know, the personal journey that's in there. And one of the things that I discovered when I wrote this was, after I went through, you know, a couple dozen versions, was I really did this type of experience, this type of thing to test myself. And the story is, I pretty much reached my up against my limits more than once. But I found that the message for myself is I found that I was, of course, vulnerable, but I was very resilient and I don't quit. I'm not a quitter. So this book shows what people, many people face in their lives, you know, some adversity and challenges, and then how they handle them and how they come out with a resolution and have a good feeling about it. So I feel good about the book. It shows me making some significant mistakes, but at the same time, keeping the team together. I was the leader, and keeping everybody together and coming out with a strong team, which produced some significant results.
Well, without giving any real spoilers, can you give us kind of a teaser about what people will find in the book?
Well, first of all, they'll find what it feels like to be really alone. So there were six of us, so you weren't wasn't alone. But where we were was about as alone as you can get, other than maybe the space station. So visualize this. We worked in the mountains, very remote from the main U.S. base at McMurdo Station, which is 2,500 miles due south of New Zealand. But we were 800 miles east of McMurdo Station. So visualize this. If you live on the West Coast, you go down to the airport in the LA airport, and then you're flying over to Denver, and you fly over, you look out the window, and immediately after you leave LA, there's nothing below you but ice, rock, snow. And for the next few hours, that's all you see. And then when you get to this place, which is called Denver, there's nothing there. It's absolutely the same. It's vacant. And then you're dropped off there. And then you're left for weeks. So this is 30 years ago, this is an age when we didn't have GPS. We didn't have satellite phones. We didn't have the internet. We didn't even have walkie-talkies. So we had a shortwave radio where we contacted McMurdo Station every day to tell us, you know, we're still here. And that was a 20-watt radio, and we really can't have a conversation on it. But yeah, being alone is like that. I mean, if I was by myself now, that would have been different than being alone with five other people. Because first of all, you have to get along with five other people in some place like that. And it's got to be teamwork. Everybody depends on everybody else. And being out there alone by myself, like a few people, adventurers of Frost Antarctica by themselves, I think that would have been way beyond my envelope.
I bet. Yeah. So you decided to write a book about it. You got some local classes and worked with some teachers. And so what was the hardest part about writing the book?
The hardest part about writing the book, which I think has been talked about by many people who have written memoirs, is to not keep secrets. You have to, if you're going to write about your own experience, you can't hold anything back, because people know you are. Readers know you're doing that, and they'll stop reading, or they won't buy the book, or nobody will recommend it to them. So it was hard to, actually take a step to reveal things, and then how to write about it, like being scared. How do you write about being scared, and or making the wrong decision, or making a discovery? There's feelings about all of those things, and feelings are pretty hard to write about. You can only write about your own introspection about feelings. You might write about some of the actions, the things you've done. But that's a tricky process, I thought.
You talk about making discoveries, and I'm sure you made quite a few discoveries. As a matter of fact, you were honored with your own mountain being named after you. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's what happens when you treat somebody who's a close colleague, this very talented person who feels some gratitude to what you've helped them do. In this case, I had a graduate student, you know, on the team, Christine. She's still working in Antarctica in these places that we've gone to. But we have obviously been in a long relationship over these decades. And she was, at the start, from the very start, grateful for this pretty big opportunity. Not many people get to do a graduate research project in Antarctica. That's pretty difficult to pull that off. So, and she did very well. So on this expedition, one of the places we camped was at the peak of this, at the foot of the peak of this mountain. And we had a horrible storm there over Christmas, lasted for days. And I was pretty freaked out about it because we were in tents. So, and, you know, and she was there, of course, also. But I remember that place. We all remember that place, being there over Christmas, the foot of this mountain, and it didn't have a name. And so she surprised me basically decades later when she and another one of my graduate students petitioned the Board on Geographic Names, the U.S. Board on Geographic Names, to name the mountain after me in honor of recognition of the research I had started and continued with over the decades in Antarctica. And it's pretty interesting. I learned a little bit about how this is done, these approval of names. I mean, you just can't randomly go to some place that doesn't have a name and then stick a name on it and then, you know, tell Rand McNally or somebody, hey, I named this. you don't do that. You have to go through the bureaucracy. And so this bureaucracy, which I learned about after the fact, was various government agencies. Well, first of all, the National Science Foundation, to legitimize, well, yeah, this guy made some contributions. Then the U.S. State Department and the Homeland Security, the U.S. Geological Survey, which kind of is a keeper of names, and the CIA. I mean, they want to make sure that this person that is getting the name isn't a criminal or a terrorist. So that he's he or she's an actual legit person. So it's pretty convoluted process, which I had no idea until this happened.
So you got the book written and you felt you got to the point where you have a draft that you are ready to put out there for publication. So once you felt like you'd written the book, how did you go about getting it published or getting it edited or, you know, getting it out there where people could read it?
I thought I had finished my book multiple times, but I was wrong because I changed it many times. So I started by, when I was taking classes with Shelley Lowenkopf, I wrote chapters. I started with the chapters which were most vivid to me. And then I put the chapters together in a story. And he helped me with some key ideas, and Tony did also. And then I got a professional editor I handled to help me write a book proposal, a nonfiction book proposal, because this is a memoir, a nonfiction memoir. And that person, Elizabeth Lyon, who's written several books on publishing and editing, she suggested I enter contests with what I'd written. So you can enter a chapter or an excerpt or something like that. And I did that. And she suggested one place, the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, PNYWA, P-N-Y-W-A, PNYWA, which I entered. And it was also a place, and I also entered and took my work to the Santa Barbara Writers Conference. I did that at least once. Once. You know, to get some honest, hard feedback. But at PNYWA, they put me together in this contest. They put me together with some people who had some, you know, really brilliant suggestions, which I followed. And I was able to finish the book, the first version. And I told my editor, Elizabeth, that I had first version and I wanted to get an agent. And she said, well, we have agents that go to PNYWA, just like who go to Santa Barbara Writers. And you need to pitch them, and you need to pitch them with a proposal. First you ask them if they'll look at a proposal, and then you send them a proposal, and then it goes from there. So I did that. I pitched, I think, a dozen that she had, Elizabeth, recommended from PNYWA. And I had also had pitched some agents at Santa Barbara Writers. But I got two responses from the PNYWA queries I sent to agents. And then I sent them a book proposal I had. And one of the agents, who's in New York City, I've actually never met, took me on. So she signed me on for a contract, and she started submitting to her favorites, to her faves, you know, her contacts. And what she got back over the course of probably a year was pretty much what I told you early on the interview here, which that was too scientific, and that was the major. The two concerns was it was too scientific, and therefore the audience is narrow. OK, Okay. But I knew after I had written the book that it's not scientific enough to go to a university press because it's not a book on scholarship. It's a book about an experience. So I had to repeatedly revise my book in terms of clearing out the science in terms of what a layperson could understand and putting it in the back of the book, as I mentioned earlier. So right now, so the way it is now, a person who, you know, reads the newspaper or watches, goes online and is curious about different scientific topics can probably get through it and be happy about it. Other people who want to learn about an experience in an extreme place like this, they can sort of breeze through the science and get through the book and enjoy it. I've been told that. Well, I got to the science part and just like breeze through it, didn't scratch my head on it. So eventually I've got responses from publishers. So this is an, if you want me to continue, I can tell you about these interesting experiences with publishers.
Okay.
So one publisher, I won't name who they are. One publisher said, hey, this could work for us. They're looking at my proposal now, not the book. Hey, they can look for us. This could work for us, but we really don't have much to offer in terms of an advance. So my agent said, well, why don't we put these folks on the back burner, go out and hit up a few more publishers, then if we don't get anything better, we'll go back to them. So that's what happened. We went out to a few more publishers who didn't like it. So we went back to this one publisher that said, this could work. Well, we find out after we go back, it was like 3 months, the editor had left.
Ugh.
So, but then and the new editor said, never mind. that was gone.
Oh, so sorry to hear that.
So then we kept on plugging away, and I went to one publisher, and like 3 or 4 years into this, where the opposite happened, we went to one publisher who said, I don't think so. And then my agent found that the acquisition editor changed there at this publisher. And they had picked up a different one of her books, a different author. So we went back to that publisher with a different editor, the new editor, and that editor loved it. So it worked the opposite. It was a year later between the first rejection and then when it was accepted. So now I'm with Permuted Press, which is an imprint of Post Hill Press, which is distributed by Simon & Schuster. And I have a non-traditional contract. If that's interesting, I can talk about that. But anyway, I have a contract that's not the traditional contract.
Yeah, what do you mean, not a traditional contract? For anybody who is possibly going to get this kind of contract.
Yeah, a traditional contract is you commit to the book based on either the full manuscript or a proposal, and then there's a royalty agreed on to the agent and to the author. This arrangement is a hybrid contract in the sense that you've done all of what I just said, but what's different is the agent gets 15% royalty, but the author and the publisher share the profits. It's profit sharing. So this is called, I understand, a hybrid contract. So it's not for nothing, but you're not getting a royalty, and you could get a good big profit share. So it's a bigger gamble, for, I think, an author, but not as much as a gamble for a publisher, because the publisher is not paying royalties. If this book is a bomb, they're only paying me a share of whatever profit there is, if there's any. That's the way I interpret it personally.
So, but now it is published and just recently dropped into stores all over the place. So now what are you doing to promote it?
If you ask me, what's the big surprise on writing a book besides letting go of the notion to start with that you really can, you know how to write a book? Because you don't know how to write a book until you started to write a book. And then you learn, if you've got good people around you, you learn what not to do so you actually can write. So that's 50% of it, I think, because the next 50% of it is selling it. You got a book, now you got to sell it. And that's a complete black box to me. And so I had to hire a publicist to help me design a marketing publicity plan. So what we're doing is we're, shorten the story, is we're doing social media and we're doing personal appearances and we're doing radio interviews and we're doing podcasts. But social media, we're doing some of the usual suspects, and we're doing, I have a blog. I've been blogging for years. That's really not getting the most traffic, but I'm doing Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn and started a little bit on TikTok because we have some videos. Experimented a little bit on Twitter, which was too much of a moving target to decide why do this. But we did find out that two important things about social media. One is to get people to look at your blog, post on Facebook or on social media and put your blog link there. That's the way I've been successful in getting people to visit my blog. The second thing I learned is the impact of doing something on Facebook and Instagram, which is called boosting, which I never heard of until I had to. And boosting is some magical thing that Facebook does with your post, sending it to targeted audiences in different locales all over the world if you want. And they charge you, but it's not a lot, actually. They don't charge you a lot.
You actually get to choose how much you want to pay.
That's right. There's a minimum on the boosts. Usually it's anywhere from $15 to $30. And then there's a length of time, which might cost you more for the boost that you want to boost the post, but... Like I had one of the boosts I had done on the post was "Where is Mount Lyandike?" And that was a blog post, which I then put a piece on Facebook, on Instagram, and then boosted it on Facebook. And I chose a English speaking global audience, and I got 35,000 impressions, whatever that means, but plus hundreds of clicks. So
that was worth it.
It was worth what was that? It cost me $35, I think.
Yeah, that's great. And you are also doing a book signing.
Right. I'm doing a book signing June 7th at Chaucer's in Santa Barbara on Upper State Street. It's at 6 p.m. So come to buy a book, and we'll bring your book that you bought, and I'll sign it, and I'll talk for a while.
Are you gonna read in the book?
I'm going to read. I'll read. I don't know what section I'm going to read of the book yet. But I don't want to read for too long. I want to mostly answer questions like we're doing here. Then I have a signing also this summer in Tecolote in Montecito, in Barnes & Noble in Ventura, because Barnes & Noble is also shelving this book. Then I have a signing up in a little boutique in Los Osos. And I'm lining up Barnes & Nobles in the L.A. Basin, Orange County area also. I'll be doing those. And I don't know if I'm going to go farther afield than that.
Well, great. It sounds like you are doing quite a bit to promote it, and it is out there now on the show. You said it's available locally in Chaucer's, is also in Barnes and Noble's all over the place. Anywhere else to get the book?
Yes, on Amazon, of course. So on Amazon, there's the hardcover, there's a Kindle, and there's an audiobook.
How did you get the audiobook done?
The publisher, Post Hill, went out and solicited audio folks, and they came up with a recorded artist, or I think that's the name of them, who do books, and they've got quite a book collection. It's a pretty solid outfit, and I did get a choice. This was interesting. I did get to audition people who read my book, because I had one of the persons that they had. Well, first of all, the publisher made a contract with the company that does audiobooks, and the company with audiobooks suggested a few people, who I auditioned, and their top pick was for a person who did most of their technical books. And I could tell when I was listening to this person audition that, yeah, if I wanted to read a book on climate change, this would be the person, you know, a scientific book, this person would be the person to listen to. But if I wanted to listen to an adventure book, probably not. So we auditioned a couple of other people and picked a person that was really into adventure, and he did a good book. He did a good job on it. So that's great. Just a lesson to me about how to go through that system.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Good luck with the book signings, and I hope you sell a lot, and hope maybe one of these days, maybe you'll get back to Antarctica.
Yeah, that's for young people.